Now we'll see how it works.
Right.
You talk to, did it, did you see me?
Right.
Okay.
Maybe we start by you telling me where you were born and when and how you came to Seattle.
Oh, I was born in Sweden, in Umeå, and came to Seattle with my parents. My father first came to Everett, rather, and not Seattle at that time. And he first came to Everett in 1909. And, my dad came first, and then he sent for the rest of the family. We arrived in November of 1909.
What did your folks do?
Well, my dad, in the old country, he together with a couple of others, they built a sawmill there, and they operated the sawmill until the panic in 1907 wiped them out. He had some other small property at that time. But then when he came to this country, he was started at Robinson Mill in Everett, where he became a cabinet maker, but still working. And he became a cabinet maker. That was his vocation for the rest of his life.
And your mother worked just in home, or she worked outside?
She worked outside. She took in washing when we first came here, and for a long period afterwards, and then later he also worked in different homes. And, so that's the sort of the pattern of their life.
Did they, do you remember them talking about politics? Is that something discussed at home?
Well, the politics, as I know it today, was not discussed. They were both very religious. But they were both working class and had a working class sympathy in the whole of their lifetime. And so that I learned a great many of the much of my output as a youth came from hearing my dad and mother discuss the struggle of boys to live and make a living. And dad always supported any strife or any struggle that took place to advance the welfare of the working.
Was he a member of the union?
At that time, there were actually no unions organized in the mills, and he didn't belong to any unions in that period.
What were you doing? Were you going to school?
I went to school in Everett, Washington School. I went to school until I was 13, and then I started to work in the mills at the truant officer, the people officer, came down and took me back to school. And so I finished the seventh grade and started working in a cannery, fish cannery in Everett. And we had very bad working conditions. We had to be there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes it's 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon before the fish came in, and then we had to hang around and wait for it in that period. And we worked through and until sometimes 11, 12, and 1 o'clock in the morning to finish off the run. So they, number of the guys got together and discussed the situation, and it was decided that there would be demand for half time for overtime. But the boss wouldn't accede to that demand, and that is half time for all waiting time between the time that we got there and the time we went to work. And so one morning the leader of the organization, that is the strike movement and the sentiment for strike, I saw them talking to a little group, and finally they said this, and everyone headed toward the door, and then the foreman and a couple of his helpers, they came and waved us all back. They said, it'll be settled, all right, just go back to work. The packers were all women, and he really depended upon their support to win the strike. Well, what happened was practically all of them went back to work, including the strike leader, a great big guy, Big George, they called him. And he went back to work. There were only eight of us who went out, one, seven men and one woman. We went out on strike. We lost the strike. And so I went back to school then. This is way into the first part of October, I guess, when we went out. And when I got back, the principal, he called me in, and why was I a whole month late getting back to school? I told him that I worked in the fish country, and we went out on strike. He really blew his stack a little bit. He's one of those who's been down with the meet the IWW down at their own, and he was deputy the commercial club.
So was this shortly thereafter, right after the Everett Master?
Oh, it was about a year. But it was 1917. From 1970, so he really had it in for me, and every opportunity to, in the 3 weeks or so that I was in school, he called me with chewing gum or being rough on the equipment because I ran up the ladder on the chute, and because on the teeter-totter, I roughened bringing the teeter-totter over from one down to another. This went on, just like one little thing after another. You'd think he had more important things to attend to. But so I thought, well, I'm not going to get an education of that kind. And so I had a friend, another, he was 15, and he had gotten a job in the Dane shipyard. So he wrote to me and said that he'd gotten a job. Why didn't I come to Seattle and try to get a job? So one weekend I took off to Seattle, and on Monday I went to, this was about a week before my 15th birthday, I went to the employment section there. They asked about how old I was, and I told them that I was going on 16. Well, he looked at me for a few minutes, and then he wrote it down, you know, and so I started work passing rivets in the shipyard. One of the first things I did was to try to go down and join the union. and they heard how old I was, they said, come back when I'm 16. That was the first thing that I took care of, to sit down and put in my application to the union. I still have the book that I issued the Boilermakers, in the Boilermakers Union, local 104. During the shipyard, my period in the shipyard, we went finally, during the war, the prices were rising and there was growing discontent at the fact that there was no increase in pay. And so there was a general striving for an increase and in wages, and we were actually promised a wage increase in 1918. We'd gotten one wage increase, and we were promised another, but it wasn't satisfactory, so we were going out on strike. And we got word that the president had said that it would stay on the job, which was along about August 1918. If he stayed on the job, that he promised that it would be satisfactorily settled. And then only a couple of months later, of course, in November, the armistice proclaimed, and we still had no settlement, and this dragged on then. February, the last of January, 1919, that we went out on strike. We've been out a while, then the general strike, the meeting of all of the trade, the appeal was from the Boilermakers for support for the, and the other craft in the shipyard. For the striking demand. And then the meeting was held, and we then, when that is done, there was a general strike in support of the shipyard strike. So during the general strike, we went down every day and got our passport, or our union book stamp, with a stamp to show that we were supporting the strike and not working. And so this is the general strike itself is rather short lived, as you are aware, and but the shipyard strike. On after the general strike for some time. And we didn't get our demands. And sometime later we got a small increase, but the shipyard strike has actually lost. There were many of the we were told that the ship owners were, or that the government was very glad to have this take place, this loss in strike and on the strike itself, but they gave them an excuse to transfer many of the contracts over to the Hog Island shipyard in the east, which is one of the big shipyards and government figures had their had money, also had interest in that type of life. So similar to the pattern.
I have a lot of questions I want to ask about that, but first I have to ask you, because this is such an amazing recollection that you just did. How much of what you just told me was things that you just remember from the days, and how much of it has been from reading you've done since then?
Well, what I've told you now is from what I remember at that time. It's much easier for me to remember back to that time than it is to remember what I read. That is what I've read, say, in the last 10 years about it.
Right, which is what most of the things that have been written on it.
Yes, that's right. Because it was, I was very impressed at that age. And, that is, I was easily impressed, and was very curious, and I had a working class outlook.
Was that I would say a self-conscious working class outlook? That is, for instance, when you're talking about the first strike, you must have been maybe 15 at
14,
the time.
14 when the ship, that is, Cambridge, strike.
And you say there were only 8 people who stayed out now.
Yeah.
Did you already have a picture of yourself as a radical of some sort, or was it?
No, I felt that we should have that, what we were demanding, and just demanding. And I had learned enough at home that I wouldn't cross the picket line.
How about by the time the general strike started? Had you
there were lots. There were at that time radicalism was not an unusual phenomenon, and the guys we worked in gangs. That is, in the riveting gang. There was a riveter, the holder-on or buckler-up, we called him the heater, and the passer. And I started passing rivets, and then I went to heating rivets, and heating rivets at that time. And the guys that I worked with, the others, they were quite radical, you know. And they were IWWs, between the riveter and the buckler-up. They were Hungarian, and were IWWs, and they were didn't hesitate to discuss, you know. And I listened and I participated in the discussion, and that was true of a lot of guys. Had a radical outlook, and saw the Soviet Union, for instance, as the working class, where the working class comes to power.
Do you have any idea, I don't know if it's your question, but what percentage of people in the shipyards were like that, considered today in the Soviet Union, the country that we indicated?
Couldn't say. I wouldn't venture a percentage, but I know that it was one could talk very openly, you know, and didn't have any problems. And of course, later on, the fact that the longshoremen at that time were, of course, also very radical, and the fact that the union record, which was the union paper, and a really strong reporter, and I think that he was a poet of paper. It dealt with the Soviet Union in a very sympathetic way, and in a very truthful way.
Is that a paper that you read normally? Was that your normal?
That was my paper, the paper that I read.
Had that been your parents' paper also?
Oh, yes. While I worked in the shipyard, after the strike, I used to buy the union record at the shipyard. And then after the strike, my parents went to Whidbey Island, and I still worked in the shipyard, and I still bought the union record. And then when I moved to Everett, when my folks moved to Everett, then I subscribed to the union record. I sent in a subscription to get my money. Until it turned. I don't recall what year now it was that it turned. That is it. But it ceased publication. But I think along 1927, 28.
Well. When the decision was made to have a general strike, but it hadn't happened yet in that intervening period, do you remember what you expected the strike to be like? Did you think of it as a potential revolution, or did you think of it as a big strike?
No, actually, when I heard that there's going to be a general strike, I thought that we now had the support that would make it possible to win our demand. And I didn't really think much in terms of any great change taking place beyond that which was projected for the general strike, and which was that I read the union records carefully, and this was the paper that I depended on for my guidance. But I know that we didn't know that we didn't see any violence. You know, I was downtown. We had this friend of mine who both had a bicycle, a young friend, and we used to ride downtown and get our book stamped. Ride back in town, but things were very quiet, and I actually didn't take much interest in the operation or organization and the functions that all went in to make the general strike the success that it was, but I saw it more as from the union guy using the rest of my time for other recreation purposes.
Did you eat in any of the striking dining halls they set up?
No, I ate at home. Uh-huh. And I used to go home.
There was no problem at home getting food?
No, it was no problem. Uh-huh. We had ample food. Things were high.
How did most of the people that you knew feel about the general strike?
Well, most of the people that I in the shipyard that I was acquainted with, they thought it was reflected labor's what labor could really do, and others that I talked with didn't have they supported the general strike and thought it was a good thing, but that is many of the others who didn't work in the shipyard. And then there were some who didn't feel that the general strike accomplished anything. But there's no great, among those that I, with whom my talk, there's no great opposition to the general strike. No real anger over it. Some thought it was nothing to gain by it, but majority of them thought it was a good thing that we did, respected the solidarity of labor.
That was afterwards or during it or both?
Oh, well, during the strike, most of those that I associated with were workers and we supported the strike.
Do you remember when the army came in?
I don't recall that.
So you don't, it didn't have an effect on
it? No, it didn't make it that much of an impression on it.
Who do you remember as the leaders of the strike?
Duncan was one of the leaders of the strike. I don't actually recall the names of the members. Even though I read Harvey O'Connor's book, I don't recall.
What sort of people were they? Were they?
They were
union people,
yeah.
Or IWW people?
No, they were union. They were members of the union. Actually, there was a good deal of anger at the treatment that the workers had gotten from the government, and as well as that they were getting from the shipyard owners. This was a pretty prevailing feeling that they were that they've been given a lot of promises, and now that the need for them had ended from the standpoint of patriotic contribution. Now they could go to hell as far as the owners of the shipyard, and the government was concerned. They just weren't needed, and they ought to be thankful that they had a job. And that kind of an attitude, and there were a lot of real anger over the fact that there was no interest in the problems that the working people were having to face in the inflation and so forth. I think it would be better if you talk perhaps to his wife, because he's usually down in the basement working.
Just set it up through her.
Yeah. And
see if there are other things about the strike that I wanted to ask you. Why did the general strike end?
Why? Actually, pressure from the, as I recall, pressure from the more conservative element in the leadership of the trade union about participating in the general strike.
So it came from within the union movement itself?
Yes, as I recall, this was some of it, but there was intense pressure, of course, from the outside, and there's where the real pressure came from that caused wavering among those from on the inside, the more conservative element.
What sort of pressure on the outside?
Oh, there was newspaper there was also, of course, the real clamor. There was the Seattle mayor's calling for help, troops and federal help, and his declaration that we were on the, as I recall, on the eve of a revolution in Seattle. and this generated lot of pressure from other groups as well as upon the conservative leadership. And so and then there was, I've forgotten who first began to buckle under it, but it sort of took that that pattern developed of pressure from outside. And then there were, as I recall, there were. More conservative labor leaders were back east, and when they came back, they had put a lot of pressure on bring about an end to the strike. So,
did they think that the strike was bad for the labor movement?
In that context, I don't know. They had doubts about following that pattern to support, and they didn't have the rank and file working class solidarity output that was very prevalent among the workers. An opportunist position.
Uh-huh. What did most of the community feel about it afterwards? Did they feel it had been a good thing for the labor movement?
Well, perhaps that wasn't so much discussed. Except as it affected individuals. For instance, when I went, I recall when I went back to work in the shipyard, one guy that I walked with, and he had two shoes that didn't match. One of them had a hole in the top here, and I commented on it. And he said, well, he stripped down to where this was all that he had to wear. And there were many of them who were, because of the fact that there never was enough money made by the workers to have any savings account, there were many of them that were just bankrupt and deprived everything they had was gone.
Was that a result of the general strike or the
original
strike?
No, it was a prolonged the shipyard strike. Oh. No, the general strike itself, I don't think had any great effect economically speaking on the workers. It was of too short a duration.
How did they feel about the general strike?
The workers in the shipyard? Yeah. They felt that it was good. They felt that it should have been. If it had been continued, they I think that it won the strike. Should be up to now.
Did it feel like the general strike affected either you or the city significantly?
Well, our family, that is folks and ourselves, we were pretty well took everything we had. That is that strike struggle, and shortly thereafter they moved out. Folks moved out to Whidbey Island. But this was also because of the realization that the shipyard contracts were being terminated, and that working in the shipyard was a matter of rather short duration. To look forward to, and so that an opportunity to go to work at the Robinson Mill again. I found too that where I worked at Ames Shipyard, when the ways after they launched the ship, they were not laying keel for follow-up ships on all of the ships, so that we realized that they were that was coming. Period, the not too distant future when we were going to be all laid off. And because they laid them off, but when they didn't lay a keel, they had to lay off the whole section of the workers. So I left the shipyard before it actually closed and got a job in Everett. I went to Everett, as a matter of fact, first to get a job in the shipyard there because they were laying the keel to a ship, but it never got beyond the keel stage. And when I left Seattle, I was still in anticipation. I was going to work in the sawmill until they got the keel, until they got this matter of the financing of the ship yard settled, but it never got off the ground. So I continued to work at the mill.
Did the general strike itself change the way people thought about labor, or the way you thought about labor, or was it not that significant an event?
Well, I don't think that, from my experience, it didn't change significantly. The problem was that there was a change taking place in Seattle during that time, as the shipyards were closing, and which was not attributed to the strike, but rather the closing was attributed to the fact that the strike had been seized upon as an excuse by employers. This is the attitude and the feeling that those that I talked to have had in the shipyard before that. So, but there were undoubtedly in the business circles, this is where they would like to place the blame, on the workers and those who were not on strike. That this was not the case, and the workers, those that I worked with, they didn't feel that that was the case either.
What did you go on to do with what sort of job you did after the strike?
Well, I worked in the sawmill in Everett. I worked at Robinson's some time, and then I worked at Builder Supply, and another cabin shop I just blew in at Robinson's Mill. I patched porch coggins, which is probably something that is a rare sight now to see a porch coggin, but at that time I patched porch coggins and shipped thousands. From that plant, we shipped thousands of porch coggins all over the United States. But then I also worked in a grocery store in Everett for a short time. I worked at Builder Supply in Everett for quite a while also. Then we went to California, and I worked in a hardware store in California for some time. And Then we were going to homestead in Alaska, and my dad and I went up to Alaska, and we actually bought a homestead, 160 acres, that we were going to buy, we had the man who had owned it had died, and his heirs in Spokane and Switzerland were desirous of selling it, and we could have bought it for $500. And so we had made all of the arrangements, and we went back to California to continue work for a short time. And then when we bought cows and had bought tools and everything, we were going to go up to Alaska then on the following freighter that was up. And we'd gotten everything, we were shipping it from San Francisco up to Seattle, and then it was deadheaded up to Seattle, and then we were going to get the cattle here, that is in Everett, in this vicinity, and then we were going to get them up to Alaska, of course. And when we took our stuff down to the dock in San Francisco, on the way back, my brother had a hemorrhage in the lung, my mother became so concerned, and he was in bed for a long time, and was unable to overcome the immediate effects of it. And so he was still there in bed when we got up here, and she was so worried about it that she finally called. Decided that it would be better if we located here, and that is in this area. And so we located it in Arlington. And my brother then became well enough that he could come up to Arlington. He we built a house there on a farm up the stump ranch at Cisco Heights, and my brother stepped out on the porch, and gradually he, although he had several hemorrhages in the lung, gradually began to improve, and entirely overcame it in later years. So, this is sort of the a little of the subsequent background, and then when I was, maybe you're not, you may not be interested in that
talk. No, I have.
Pardon?
Are you
oh, well, I was, then as a stump, when we worked on the stump ranch, we cleared land there, and there was no work. This was during the 30s, early 30s, 32s. So I worked on WPA a while, and then I was an old visitor. She suggested that I try to work for adult education, on adult education, because I had a number of discussions with her about the economic situation. And so I went, she finally induced me to go down and have an interview, although I said, I know it's no use. She had told me that it required 2 years of college, and I said, well, that's out. But she, but I went down anyway, so they took me on, and I on a workers' education for some time, and then I, we had a very reactionary senator from the 39th Legislative District there. And at that time I belonged to the Washington Old Age Pension Union, and also our Workers' Alliance. We carried on many struggles on the welfare, for welfare there. And so one of the legislators there in Holmes County, he asked if I would run for the state senate to see this guy, reactionary Tyron Reardon, his name, the senator. And I was very reluctant to do so, but I said I would try to find someone up there who would. I knew both of the representatives there very well, and I couldn't induce them to run. So on the last day, I finally said, okay, I'll go up and file. So I and another fellow drove the car, and I went up there and I filed about 5 minutes before closing the file, closing the filing. So then I was elected to the state senate, and I got a ticket. But then I was vice president for the second congressional district, Washington, for the Washington Old Age Pension Union.
What sort of ticket did you run on?
Pardon? I ran on the Democratic Party ticket. And they brought charges of communism against me when they were going to seek me. And so that they then set up a committee to hear, an investigating committee. This investigating committee took the greater part of 10 days, and the Seattle Times was complaining that nothing was being done by the legislature as a result of this. And they said, in an editorial, they said that I should be seated because I've been elected by the constituents. And committee that was set up to investigate me, the majority of that committee recommended that I be seated. And by a 3-2 majority, and they took 7 pages to set forth my qualifications, stating that the work in my in Snohomish County in public power work and other activities in the public utility, in the public utility district activities, was commendable, and therefore they recommended that I be seated. And the minority report, in just 7 words, it said, we recommend that you be not seated. And the hysteria was so great in the Senate chambers because this came shortly after the Finnish Soviet War, and there was a great hullabaloo created during that period, and a great sweep of hysteria, actually, was great as during the McCarthy period, in many respects. And the Senate adopted the minority report, which deprived me of my seat. We carried on. Excuse me. My whole campaign was built around the needs of the people, you know. I campaigned on Initiative 141, which is one of the most enlightened pension programs ever brought before the American people, and despite all of the red baiting, you know, Initiative 141 carried by 350,000 to 250,000, won by 100,000 votes, and they tried to red bait it to death, you know. Couldn't do it. So this was a part of the program that I ran on. And, so this was
Now, at that time, at the time that they did that, were you a member of the CP? Were you?
Or as the records bring out, in 1938, in 1939, I was a member of the party, and then I took leave of
the F. Was that to run without that around your neck?
You see, we have what many people don't understand is that we have an open primary in the state of Washington. Any Democrat can run on a Republican ticket, and any Republican can run on a Democratic ticket. And anyone who says that a communist doesn't have a right to run on a former communist doesn't have a right to run on any ticket that is in one of these tickets. On one of these tickets, ballots, just has a one-sided outlook on it. and so we had quite a long battle and court battle.
It did go to the court.
Yeah, we took it to court in Snohomish County, and they. Wouldn't accept the jurisdiction of it, stating that the jurisdiction properly belonged in Thurston County, where the action against me was taken. And then when I took it to Thurston County, they wouldn't act on it, stating that it was the position of the court that it could not intervene in the affairs of the legislature because of the separation of powers, and so that was just a bit.
So that was the end of it there. What other organizations did you belong to in your life? Was 38 the first time that you entered the CP?
Oh, it's 38. Then, of course, I rejoined the party after my experience. I've been in the party since.
Is there any, were there other organizations? I mean, were they mostly CP-affiliated organizations?
No, I belong to the state union. I've worked in any primary, anyone can go to any primary here in the state of Washington, and you can say that you're a member of the Communist Party if they're not so redneck that they deprive you. You can participate in the discussion. I belong to a number of trade unions.
No fraternal or religious organization?
No, not any religious organization. I don't recall whether I belonged to any fraternal. Well, I did belong to Vasa Lodge, the Swedish Vasa Lodge, which is a fraternal organization.
This is a large question. Since the time of the strike, what do you think have been the most important events that have happened in the country or in the world?
Since when?
Since the time of the general strike in 1919.
Well, there have been a great number of important events. I would say that emerging out of the Second World War, the growing chain of socialist countries emerging in the world is perhaps the most significant for well-being is concerned, and is perhaps the greatest deterrent to war, the emergence of colonial countries from colonialism to freedom from colonialism is one of the really great events, and it can't be called an event because it is a chain that is still proceeding to develop, and the event will be of long duration if one can term it an event. But then, of course, the present struggle in Africa is of enormous significance beyond that which perhaps those viewing it, that is merely reading the newspaper, goes far beyond that. As one examines the forces in the world today, that the big monopolies and their struggle for raw materials and sources of cheap labor and for markets no longer is it confined to the weaponry of 50 years ago, but the mass weaponry of overkill, of the nuclear weapons, places the situation of the present time within the context of the danger of the world annihilation. And we have had in the leadership of our own country has not reflected any desire, any great desire to move toward disarmament. In fact, when one takes a look at the SALT talks at the present time, and one looks at the history of the two countries primarily in interested and involved in these SALT talks, we see that in the land of socialism, where the working class has power, there from the very beginning of socialism, it was an effort to a struggle to maintain world peace. But even after the Second World War, the leaders of our country and the big monopolies, they carried on a struggle to rearm Japan. This was one of the conditions under one of the efforts under, despite the fact that Japan had been required to forswear rearming. When it came down to the pinch, Japan had written into its constitution also that it would not rearm. And yet Dulles brought the pressure to bear upon Japan that if it wanted economic aid, it would have to rearm. And so, and I have a whole series of clippings that would be very interesting to read out of the Seattle Times, Seattle PI, of that period, in which it details the fact that they are required to rearm in order to get the aid from the United States, economic aid from the United States. So this is not the type of a history that would indicate that the leadership in the disarmament struggle today is coming from these forces. And the Austrian, when the question, I also have clippings from the Seattle Times and PI, and when the Austrian, the question of Austria's neutrality was raised, the U.S. and the Western, its Western allies, opposed the Austrian neutrality, stating that it ought to have the right to be on the side of the West, but so that the future rests with those who are able to carry on the struggle and win the struggle for peace in the world, and that means the involvement of the people in whose interest that is, and not and that leadership will not come from the armament manufacturers who see the profits, the great profits that they had in the past gotten from armaments, and that they see as the means of blackmailing and threatening and many of these colonial countries as well, and where they see the hope and the opportunity of reestablishing the main countries. And when you take a look at the after World War II, that we supported the French in Indochina,
okay.
Now we'll see how it works.
Right.
It ought to did it at okay.
Maybe we can start by you telling me where you were born and when and how you came to Seattle.
Oh, I was born in Sweden, in Umeå, and came to Seattle with my parents. My father first came to Everett, rather, and not Seattle at that time. And he first came to Everett in 1909. My dad came first, and then he sent for the rest of the family. They arrived in November of 1909.
What did your folks do?
Well, my dad, in the old country, he together with a couple of others, they built a sawmill there, and they operated the sawmill until the panic in 1907 wiped them out. He had some other small property at that time. But then when he came to this country, he was, started at Robinson Mill in Everett, where he became a cabinet maker.